Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from Easy Street here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And with us today is a writer and entertainment journalist and overall fan of pop culture, Ashley Spencer. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
And thank you for picking this, because the thing is, we're doing every theatrically released movie in 1999. This was not theatrically released. However, this was a pleasure. And it was also directed by an Oscar-winning director. Yeah. And I think that, you know, solidifies its bona fides in terms of why it's an important piece for what we do, aside from just being a piece that came out in the particular year that we covered exhaustively. So
I would also say, too, for what it's worth, just because this was an enormous hit. Like, in terms of 27 million people watched this live, aired on ABC for The Wonderful World of Disney. That's pretty shocking. I mean, that's like basically Super Bowl numbers now. So this was not, I mean, yes, it didn't get released theatrically, as you said, Kenny, but like, this is not a small thing. Like I'm not sure that I knew how big this was. I know Ashley and people within
I knew.
but I think that within your age demographic, I have a fair amount of friends who love this movie, love this rendition of it. But I had no idea how popular it really was. Kenny, you mentioned before we hopped on mic that this is your favorite adaptation of Annie.
Well, the thing with Annie is, now I've never seen it. I've never seen a proper version on stage.
Okay.
I have seen several improper versions on stage.
Will Gluck's version, for instance? Have you seen that one?
I truly despise that. But my daughter was in a version of Annie 4 months ago. Okay. So the songs are very much in my head. I've seen the original.
Was she Annie?
Let's not talk about that.
was she in it though?
There was 14 girls in the play. Okay. So they started basically doubling up on roles and whatever. So she was Mrs. Greer and Drake and an orphan and a Boylan sister. So
she does it all.
Yeah.
So
those are some prime smaller roles.
Yeah. I mean, when you put them all together, you got some good stuff. But there are, every kid in the play had like meat, right? They all had their song and their moment and whatever. And it was good. So that's Annie for me. I don't like the original
82.
It's 82.
It kind of gives
it
me
it went the, rogue 82 went rogue. I don't know what they were doing.
It gives me the willies a little bit.
It's creepy.
It is. There's something just like, even as a kid, because I definitely watched it as a kid, there was something that made me never want to watch it again. And I think the Will Gluck version is a disaster piece.
It's a disaster. Yeah. But I don't know what they were thinking on that one. Because like for a long time, forgive me, but like, was there not a Jay-Z version because of his song, right? There was a moment
was
he a producer on it?
I don't know. No.
He was attached originally.
Yes, that's what I was going
to
say.
Okay. I don't know that he stuck around to the end. Will Smith also, and it was originally going to star
Willow. Yeah.
Willow.
Yeah.
But things shifted and I don't know if it was ever going to be a masterpiece. The modernizing of Annie is an interesting thing to try and do. I think there are merits to that, but when you add in auto-tune and suddenly Daddy Warbucks is a cell phone tech mogul named Will Stacks, you're trying to be too cool with Annie, and Annie's not cool.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. Like, I was watching it last night, and I was thinking about how deeply uncool this is, and yet how undeniably charming and just good-natured and like it's sort of bulletproof in its own way, and yet it seems like people have fucked it up in ways that are sort of confounding. Like, I don't know. I understand, you know, Jay-Z obviously had that big song, Forgive Me. I don't know what the name of the song is.
Hard Knock Life. Part one. Yeah.
Right. So he does his, which is a great song, and I can understand why he's like, fuck it, I'll produce an Annie, a modern Annie. Like, in theory, on paper, that sounds like a good idea. And then to your point, Ashley, then you actually get into the, you know, the meat of it, and you're like, we shouldn't do this. Why are we doing this?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's some interesting things at play, like making her a foster kid rather than an orphan. Like, that's relatable. You know, kids watching it might identify with that.
Right.
But like, when I was watching the 99 version, I think what struck me is just like, this is a made-for-Disney story. Like, it's shocking that Annie wasn't a Disney property to begin with, because it is a Cinderella fairy tale, happy ending, rags to riches. Like, it feels right. It feels like it belongs on Disney. Yep. And people that have tried to stray from that have done a disservice, including 82, which...
Yeah. Even just, like, the villains in this feel like Disney villains. Do you know what I mean? Like Mrs. Hannigan and Rooster, they all feel very much of built from a Disney universe. I agree with you. It's surprising that it took this long for Disney to do it. Now, forgive me, I haven't seen the 82 version. What is it that is so sort of Uncanny Valley about it? Or what is
Uncanny Valley is a really good term for it.
Yeah. So I saw 99 first. So I think you're a little bit prejudiced probably with what you saw first and liked first.
Right.
So I fell in love with 99. And then as a kid, I was like, oh, there's more Annies. I'll go watch 82. And I don't even know that I made it all the way through that one at the time. So 82, first of all, it had a $50 million budget in 1982 versus the $12 million they had in 99. And I feel like they blew it because...
Oh, it's a big movie.
It's big. And it looks more cinematic. It feels more like a proper movie than, you know, 99 feels like an NBC live musical in a lot of ways. But what 82 did, they strayed from the Broadway musical in a lot of ways. So 1977, it had opened on Broadway, became a huge hit. Yeah. They wanted to adapt it into a movie, but instead of just kind of sticking to what made it magical, which was a simple-ish story, they pumped it up with like way more. Like there's, I think, you know, the Cold War was going on. So there's like the Bolsheviks bombed Daddy Warbucks' house. And like that happens. The end is now this like high-speed chase with Rooster chasing Annie up a raised drawbridge. He knocks out Miss Hannigan. Like it ends with her like sprawled, maybe dead on the ground, I think. It's almost like that final scene from The Undoing, like Hugh Grant, like there's like a massive chase. Like they just tried to make it, and maybe there was, you know, I'm sure there was studio pressure. If you're going theatrical, we need to like get the drama in there. But it just became really big. Also, there's tons of racism. They added these characters. There's like, Daddy Warbucks has a servant named Punjab who is like in an Indian turban, but he's played by a Trinidadian American man and is just there to be silent and like do some magic things. It's like, it's so far from what Annie needs to be that it's too much.
Daddy Warbucks is dancing on a pinhead to begin with. And if Daddy Warbucks is not like morally flawless, the movie falls apart. So because you know he's a billionaire, so pretty good chance he's done some shit, and he, you know, he really like again. So I have a lot. I mean, I have some thoughts about Annie. Go ahead, Ashley.
Well, you're probably closer to the stage show, having, I assume, watched your daughter in her recent production. And I haven't actually seen a live show of it, I think, in my life. So I've only read about what the original was. But as far as I can tell, the original, like, politics are kind of baked into Annie. Like, there is a lot of FDR, and which isn't the Disney version.
It's like Great Depression stuff,
Yes, there is. But I think that the original Broadway show, like, Annie goes to, like, a Hooverville and... you know, mingles with different sorts of people. And then a big plot line is that they go to DC and she influences the New Deal. Like FDR adopts the New Deal because Annie is so optimistic and it makes him.
That is.
So wait, is Annie Forrest Gump? Annie's
got some Forrest Gump in her. And Annie is a bit of a like almost magical character. In every other iteration, and I don't mean magical in terms of she has magic power, a Forrest Gumpish character, and she has this ability to kind of just her presence charms the pants off everybody who's there. Mm-hmm. I want to make this very clear. None of the other Annies I find charming at all. This Annie I find extremely charming.
Yeah.
And she isn't utilized the same way as the other ones. Mm-hmm. She's just charming because she's a kid. She's not
there's a purity
like,
to her.
There's a very weird streak running through the 82 Annie, which is like, Annie's going to kick your ass.
Annie is angry in 82.
And she's like fucking people off the left. She's always like this, right? And it's this weird thing where like, she's charmed. Like the player is charming, but there's always this strain of violence running through this character that was always very off-putting to me as a kid and then as an adult. I mean, this Annie is really playing it for very purely, very innocently, very naturally, and she really feels like a kid. I was totally taken with this performance.
Yeah, very Disney. I mean, to be fair, like maybe a kid that grew up in the orphanage that has been through what Annie's been through might be always, you know, fists up, have more issues than what we see in 99 Annie. But I love 99 Annie, who is Alicia Morton. I think, you know, they really made her feel like a 99 kid, like even to the hairstyle. She has that middle part kind of chin length bob, which was all the rage. I had one. Her red hair is more of like brunette with
Auburn,
a tinge.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's more natural than what we saw in the wig in 82. So I think she felt like she could just be, you know, your friend. And yes, it's set in the Depression, but like it's not that different from your life. Whereas 82, she was like, their clothes, they were super dirty. Like they looked, it was like real rough.
Well, it was real rough.
Sir, I think that, and again, having only seen this film and I couldn't finish the recent one. I tried, but I couldn't finish it. But this is a surprisingly grounded adaptation, all things considered, right? Like this is still a musical. And this speaks to Rob Marshall as his career progresses as well. This idea of him trying to find that delicate balance of suspense of disbelief and what people are willing to go along with in a movie musical. I mean, Chicago, you know, famously everything takes place inside her head, which gives them the freedom to be able to kind of do whatever they want to do and not break that sort of people singing for no reason rule that audiences seem to have for some ungodly reason. But this
I don't
film,
care about that rule.
No, I know it? You don't. I know. Yes. And neither do I, to be clear. But I just think that it's interesting that this adaptation feels like no one is overly cartoonish. I feel like no one crosses some sort of threshold into becoming a living cartoon character, despite the fact that it is a very theatrical piece. Like, I think that like there's a version of this where Kathy Bates is much bigger and much crazier, yes. Right? Like there's a version of this where
you should see Carol Burnett's performance.
Right, which
well,
I'm
that, well, that's the other main difference is that Carol Burnett in the 82 version is an alcoholic and kind of more like a, almost like a brothel madam. Like she's very, yes. Saucy and
that's
up for anything. And Kathy Bates, God, I think, you know, she
crazy.
Said, I would recommend actually watching it just so you can understand
check it out now,
the depth
for sure.
of depravity. But, Kathy Bates, I think, you know, she said she saw her Miss Hannigan as just like exhausted, like a middle-aged woman who has just like had enough and is tired. And I think that's part
Which
of the realism
feel.
As well.
Yeah.
Like you can relate to that more maybe than what Carol Burnett
And then at
doing.
The other end of the spectrum, you have the Cameron Diaz performance, which is...
Which is much more in line with Carol Burnett.
Carol Burnett, but also like became essentially an internet meme for a brief time there where everyone was just like, how did this get so far... a lot like how did we lose this like the thread just got lost
well the thread I mean I do think that it's somewhat instructive. I think we were talking about it in the beginning, but Jay-Z broke Annie a little bit by using it, right? Like that sample should never have been used on a Jay-Z record, not for any other reason other than it made it something in the pop culture's consciousness that pop culture was not able to square with its source material. And proof of that is the 2014 movie where they tried to take that song and make a movie out of it, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's a disaster. Like the thing about 99 Annie and Annie the musical, and I actually used the term magic, and I do think it's magic to some extent, is that it's about as simple a story as you can come up with for a Broadway musical. And the secret of this musical is it only like kind of exists as like a cake pan for these incredible songs. Like there are four or five really wonderful Broadway numbers in this. And then the thing that Rob Marshall brought to it that he deserves all the credit in the world for is some incredibly beautiful and complicated choreography that was
with kids.
The orphan song is amazing.
Yeah, you're never
the Hard Knock Life, the buckets.
Hard Knock Life was great, but.
What the hell is it called? Sorry,
it's
called
a smile. I can hear. You're never fully dressed.
You're never fully dressed without a smile. Yeah. Was really great. So that stuff with kids, and you know, it's like I was just on. I was on You're Missing Out, and I talked about Top Hat, And what I love about choreography and dancing in show, in television and movies and whatever, is it's the original special effect. It's the original, yeah. Like you're sitting there and you feel like you're watching magic. And I do get the sense that Rob Marshall understands that. So that's that. That's the part of that's what I really loved about this. Even though this is like this is almost like a review, of Annie. Right? This is this is not Annie. I mean, and I don't care that it's not the story of Annie. It's kind of a silly story. But the beats, if you line them up, hardly make sense. There's almost no character progression in this movie. There's almost no evolution. There's no growth. None of it matters to me. I don't care.
Daddy Warbucks comes around. He only wanted a boy orphan, and now he's happy.
For a beat, like a line, for a second. And only because he's a dope, he didn't realize there are such things as girl
orphans. He's not the brightest. We're not sure how he got the
money. How he made all those millions. I do want to just take a second to talk about Rob Marshall, because Kenny, you brought it up, but I want to kind of hone in on what I think he's very, very good at. And what I would argue he's not particularly good at. I think that to your point, Kenny, he completely understands, like, this is just a bunch of bangers. Like, these are great songs. Get out of the way. Let them sing them. Let the songs be the thing that speaks volumes. We'll have great dance, but like it's not particularly showy. Admittedly, you did say earlier actually only had $12 million, so who knows? And we've seen what he can do with hundreds of millions of dollars. But I do think that there is something very clean about this, Kenny, in the sense he's just like, let the songs speak for themselves. The songs are great. And I would argue that he's shown that moving forward as well. I think he knows that Chicago is a great musical, right? And if I get out of the way, it's going to be fine.
I think what he gets and what I actually really like about him as a director, because I think Chicago is pretty good. I don't think it's the best, but I think it's like
pretty good.
Very good. Like somewhere. Yeah, somewhere between pretty good and very good, right?
Yeah.
I think what I like about him is Phil, we've done a few plays that were adapted. And whenever you have a play that's adapted, you have that criticism of it just feels like a film, feels like a filmed play. Yeah. But with movie musicals, directors almost always go in the other direction, which is take it outside, build the world up, add these extra elements. And I, as a counterweight, I like the idea of just feels like a film stage musical. That's what I love about Chicago. That's what I love about Bob Fosse Productions. And that's what I really like about this. And this, again, is not, you know, in any way, this doesn't have the raciness of a Fosse musical, of course. But I like that this feels like the kind of thing that would make a young person, a 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old want to investigate Broadway more. And that's cool to me. Mm-hmm. This is a great entryway. So
can I ask you a question, Kenny, just because Kenny brought something up and I wanted to just quickly follow up on it. You brought up Fosse. Kenny's a very big Bob Fosse fan. Rob Marshall essentially kind of launches his career on a revival of Cabaret on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Starring Alan Cumming, who is then in this. And then he does Chicago. I would argue that Rob Marshall's greatest weakness might very well be that I don't particularly think he has anything, a vision of his own yet. Like, I don't know. If you show me a frame of a Rob Marshall movie, I'm not sure that I could tell you what it is. He's a little bit invisible as a filmmaker. And he kind of got his bona fides riding Bob Fosse's coattails. So what are our thoughts on that?
Not a bad guy's coattails to ride. And just very few people do it and have done it. I think he's trying very hard to find his own visual style. And I think you watch a movie like Nine and you can see the ways in which he's trying to break out and the ways in which he's trying to differentiate himself, you know, kind of use what's available to him as a modern filmmaker. And Nine's just not a very good musical. So,
Nine doesn't exist, Kenny. I don't think that people know Nine.
I've erased what happens in Nine.
It's just Eight and a Half.
Burlesque. In my mind, those two movies kind of like the same.
I think there are people who would riot if they heard you were.
I know.
if you went on Twitter right now and you're like, hey guys, did you know that Daniel Day-Lewis was in a musical directed by Rob Marshall? People would be like, really? I had no idea.
Kate Hudson was the best part.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Ashley? Sorry.
Well, I think, you know, it's important to note that 1999 Annie is Rob Marshall's directorial debut. Like,
it is.
This is his first TV or movie anything. He came from theater. He came from choreography, which is obviously evident in his work. But he had choreographed the 1997 Brandy Whitney Cinderella. And that's what led him to doing this. And apparently on that set, he was, you know, basically acting as a director in many moments. And the producer said, hey, maybe he can handle this. So that this was his launch pad to everything, was Annie.
It was, for sure. And I mean, you know, I know that we keep saying this, but it should be said, like, there's real competence here. Kenny and I have watched Smart House. Okay. So we've been in the Smart House.
We've been in the Smart House.
Great movie.
I have watched Xenon. These Disney Channel movies aren't necessarily of the highest quality, let's just say. And I think that, Kenny, would you agree that Rob Marshall's direction here is better than LeVar Burton's direction of Smart House?
Yeah, at the risk of insulting you, LeVar Burton's number one fan. Yes, I think he exceeded LeVar's direction of Smart House. But again, he had $12 million, and I think LeVar had $12,000.
And LeVar was working with, you know, an original script, an original Disney. Rob was given a leg up with an established, you know, beloved story to tell.
But I think that it's a testament to what we were talking about in terms of it takes a good director to know when not to direct. Do you know what I mean? And when, like, you've got a great thing. And as we're all saying, like, you really can't, like, you have Hard Knock Life. Just let the kids sing Hard Knock Life and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, I do. I really, really do love almost every, I think I love every aspect of this. Yeah. And I think it's deceptively simple. I think it deceptively seems like he got out of the way. I don't think it can be overstated that every single thing in this movie is a set that is a designed set. I think it's cool that it's all, you know, on a back lot. It reminds me of, you know, those early 80s movies I love, like Little Shop. It has that same kind of vibe, which I think is another really strong adaptation with a really horrible ending that will destroy me forever. At least they didn't change the ending on this one. At least they were gifted a happy ending and they didn't have
a happy ending. But you bring this up and it's worth noting. They kind of tried to change the ending because apparently they did a reshoot of the end because Disney was a little worried about an interracial couple. So they shot a version of this where they don't end up together. And Victor Garber specifically acted so terribly in it. So they couldn't use it, essentially, knowing
criminal. That's criminal. Yeah. And so many
Audra. Because, I mean, Audra McDonald, is one of the best parts of this movie. So, and they plumped up her role because she has the voice of an angel. And so they gave her that tomorrow, you know, part two to do. Yes. But I think, you know, she said, yes, they called everyone, the cast and crew, back in on a Saturday to do this reshoot because some executive was worried about certain markets. Because, again, it was a TV movie. So, you know, they're catering to, you know, the masses on Sunday night. That she kind of praised Rob Marshall and said that he only did one take, and he knew if he did one take they can't use it, they didn't have enough shots, and so that he was like did one take, and then because he had everyone there he started just doing cleanups on other scenes and had them shoot, you know, redo some other stuff to make those better, and then they turned in the footage to say we shot it, and they were like, well, can't use that, and then of course it came out, like, there was no uproar, no one cared, like, everyone loved Audra, so
she's amazing.
I don't blame anybody for this, but it's noticeable that they don't kiss. And those characters always kiss. So that is a bit of a bummer to me as well. It almost defeats the purpose at that point. You know, it defeats any progress you're making by casting an interracial couple at the end. By not having them do what's scripted in every other version of this, that really does stand out to me as making concessions to the bad people.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, it, It's interesting too, because Cinderella, like we mentioned, came out 2 years earlier, and that was, you know, very colorblind casting. Yeah. Brandy, Whitney, I think you have a Filipino prince. Victor Garber is still in it as the king. He's back again.
Always.
Whoopi Goldberg. Like, you've got this amazing progress, and really just without commentary, just having that representation. And then in this version, they diversified the orphans. They, you know, kind of did that classic thing where some background players will make this a bit more inclusive, but, you know, they went with a white Annie and a white Miss Hannigan and a white Rooster and a white Lily. So in a way it was, you know, two steps back from what they'd done before, which,
and the irony being,
and also we should say Cinderella, as big as Annie was in the ratings, Cinderella was like 60 million. It was the biggest of all time. It was a huge hit, which is why Disney Annie even exists. So to think that there would be any issue with that seems like a big misstep on their part.
It's very odd. I mean, I was literally just gonna say that it's strange that you have this enormous success in Cinderella in 97 with all the diversity that you're speaking of, Ashley, and then to be like, you know, to try to pump the brakes is bizarre. Let me just give a quick synopsis for people who have not seen Annie. In this TV version of the Broadway musical, classic comic strip character Annie is rescued from the misery of Mrs. Hannigan's orphanage by Grace Farrell, whose employer, curmudgeonly tycoon Oliver Warbucks, has decided to take in an orphan for Christmas. The search for Annie's biological family begins in earnest when Warbucks decides to offer a cash prize to her parents if only they reveal themselves and return to her. It premiered on The Wonderful World of Disney on ABC on November 7th, 1999, and it's been on ABC as well as ABC Family Stars on the Hallmark Channel. And as we mentioned, 26.3 million viewers tuned in. You know, I think that there's a couple production things that are worth talking about. Kristen Chenoweth originally auditioned for Annie back in the day. I think it was for the 82 version of Annie, if I'm not mistaken.
To be little Annie.
Which I think is amazing, but was turned down because her Southern accent was too thick, apparently, which I think is, just thinking of a tiny Kristen Chenoweth sounding like Kristen Chenoweth, I think is just amazing. Because I think her voice probably sounds the same. Incredible. Mm-hmm. They changed a couple things from prior versions. There are four songs, including the original Annie song, which was not on the Broadway score. There's a subplot involving Sandy going missing in the original musical. The White House Tomorrow reprise, which was replaced by a scene involving Grace Farrell and Annie. And the ending is subtly changed in that Mrs. Hannigan, not Lily St. Reed, just pretends to be Mrs. Mudge. Mm-hmm. Apparently in 2016 on NPR with Terry Gross, Anna Kendrick said that she auditioned for a role in this TV movie, which I think is also amazing. The little girl from one of the orphans is in Modern Family.
Sarah Hyland. Yeah. Sarah Hyland.
Molly.
Also LaLanne from Lizzie McGuire, who played her best friend Miranda. She's another orphan.
That's amazing.
I
was watching it last night with my roommate, and we were just like, if only Sarah Hyland knew how unbelievably rich she was going to be for residuals on Modern Family. So I want to talk for a second just about sort of the historical components of this, because we've talked a little bit about how, like, this movie sort of hardwired in the Great Depression, takes place in 1933. So there is this sort of, is it a commentary on wealth? I mean, there is these orphans.
No.
There is the sort of haves and have nots. I mean, you don't think that there's anything going on there?
Well, the rich people come off looking good. Like isn't like the corrupt billionaire.
Rich is great.
The lesson is like, if you can get really lucky, one will take you into his fold.
This, I think it needs to be kind of stated up front. Like, this isn't high art.
I'm not saying it is.
No, I know. This is Annie, right? This is training wheels. This is Broadway with training wheels. And that's fine. Like, the value of Annie to our current culture is that it is a play with where many of the main roles are young girls.
Yeah.
The people who generally are going out for plays in elementary school and middle school. And it really works well as a local elementary school and middle school play. And it's a good way to get your to get your feet wet in this world. And I think there's value in that. Like, there's for value, sure. Like, there's value in t-ball and kickball. Like, these things, it absolutely matters. But to... it's definitely not the place to go looking for like commentary on the haves or have nots or the, you know, the evils of capitalism or anything like that, because it really is just a fairy tale. It is a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale with a rich dad instead of a handsome prince. And, and any criticism lobbed at this almost misses the point, because it's, as I said, it is just the container you put these wonderfully calibrated Broadway elements into. You have big characters, big roles, great sets, great costumes, right. You know, clearly defined motivation, clearly defined goals. And you have great songs that are in the range of most people.
I think it should also be said too, and to sort of underline what you were saying a little bit earlier, Kenny, all the what you just said is all the things that the remakes didn't understand about it, right? Like the idea
they tried to make it more than it was,
right? Like Annie doesn't need to be bigger than this. You know what I mean? Like Annie doesn't need to be chased up a roof. Annie doesn't need to. I mean, it's just interesting that. You know, sometimes just
neither does Cinderella, by the way. Like the versions of Cinderella that work are very, you know, are very narratively clean, and don't really deal with how kind of creepy a lot of the politics are and all that stuff. And I'm not really advocating that this type of art is essential. What I'm simply doing is just acknowledging that it exists. And as long as we call it what it is not, and acknowledge the places where it falls short, it's not like as dangerous as I think some people like make this stuff out to be. And we'll talk about this when we talk about Little Mermaid as well. But it's not, there are some people who think like some of these fairy tale things are dangerous for kids. I don't think that's true.
I think Malcolm Gladwell, do you think that he thinks that they're dangerous?
I think Malcolm Gladwell, we'll talk about that a lot when we talk about it. I think Malcolm Gladwell, you know, just is
a little bit of a misreading of the little.
He's little Annie. He's always got his fists up. Like really, like that's what Malcolm Gladwell is now. He's like, and he's punching the wrong people, I think sometimes. That's kind of what I think. I think there is some value in terms of this is a great place to start loving theater. That's it.
I mean, child in the title role. Like it, you know, there's a lot of musicals and a lot of theater that have iconic supporting kid actors or kid roles for kids. Like, I mean, I love the Music Les Man Mis, and there's little kids on the side, but to have a movie or a play that centers a child where you know, if you were a theater loving kid or who imagined like, oh, I could be a star. Like that's to see kids like living the dream, both in getting the part and being in the middle of this world. And then also, you know, within the story, Annie having the central role and having the happy ending. And like,
I think
it happens more now. Kids programming is a lot more common, but especially when this first came about in the 70s, like it was pretty, pretty radical.
Yeah, this is the one. This is the only one I can think of that really centers a child like this. And I think it's also worth noting, I mean, Ashley, what you're saying, there was no imperative back then. The idea of kids programming wasn't a thing. It was Sesame Street, and that was it. You were watching what your parents were watching. So this came to be because people thought it was a really great, really accessible, really, you know, a commercially viable story, not because of any weird cynical pandering like you see now.
Yeah.
The only other Broadway thing I could think that does center a child, even though it changes midway through, is The Lion King. The first half of The Lion King really is about young Simba. And it is that same kind of like those young Simba roles, because it was always kind of shared between three child actors. And I think same with Andy was shared with two or three, but those were always kind of almost shockingly
Matilda
big
now
roles.
Is Matilda, one, yeah. That, yeah. But I mean, that's interesting with Lion King too, because one of the writers on the 99 Annie was a co-writer on The Lion King and The Hunchback. So like there was some crossover with Disney. And I think even Mr. Bundles, the laundryman, is Ernie Sabella, who was the voice of Pumbaa. Yeah. So they kind of brought that back. But
Bundles has a much bigger role in the thing. It's weird to bring Ernie Sabella in for one scene and no songs. Because I love the way that guy sings. But, that's a weird thing about Kristen Chenoweth in this, too.
Yeah, she doesn't really get to sing much either.
But she's such a genius. Like, she's such a Broadway genius. It's crazy.
At that time, she would have been the least known to TV audiences of the... I mean, everyone in this
main cast, I believe,
had won Tonys already. Multiple Tonys, some of them. Alicia Morton, who played Annie, she had been on Broadway in Les Mis as Cosette. They all had that background. But I would say Kristen, probably they were thinking, let's get Kathy Bates in more scenes. And that's why they rewrote that ending to put Kathy on more and give her more screen time. But going back just to the kid thing, it's also, I think the 1982 version showcases a lot that maybe child labor laws and what you could do with kid actors was different then. Like I was rewatching it and I mean, kids are like slapping each other. Like there's like, and I don't think it's a fake slap. Like these are like kind of just stepping on their heads. I don't know if they hired professional gymnasts or they just had the kids doing backflips for fun, but the choreography, I mean, the Orphan choreography, as good as Rob Marshall was in 99, go back and watch 82 Hard Knock Life. They are doing like insane flips and twists and like Simone Biles-esque, like in the background, just like tons of randoms that you never see.
I agree with you. That's pretty cool.
The cast of Orphans was like 50 plus. This one, maybe there's 10, like more of a theatrical thing, but they went big on the Orphans in 82. And I'm sure it was a whole mess of possible child abuse.
I gotta watch this movie. You guys are making me really, it sounds insane. I want to ask though, what is your favorite Annie song? Not your favorite.
I want to say, before that, because I want to do this. Have you ever seen Robert Altman's Popeye?
Yes.
Same kind of vibe.
So very Uncanny Valley.
Yes. It's the same kind of vibe.
Unwholesome.
Like, it's not as crazy as Popeye, which is fucking nuts.
Yeah.
But Popeye's it's that same, like, you're doing the wrong thing here. All right, go ahead. Let's do our favorite.
My question
songs.
Was, what's your favorite song from Annie? Not your favorite like set piece from this movie, like just the song.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because for me, I don't know that you can do better than Tomorrow. Like, I know it's a little saccharine. I know it's a little bit, but it's just like...
Ashley, I can tell by the look on your face. I think we have the same
one. No. I've got two, I think. But let me preface this by saying, and we can talk about the soundtrack as well. I had the CD to 99. The CD was played out in my three-piece stereo in my room.
I'm going to write it down on a piece of paper, the one I think you're going to pick.
Okay. So I did fall in love with the songs separate from just watching them on screen. It became about what I could listen to and not get sick of. And I was a weird kid who loved theater and wanted to be a theater kid, but I wasn't actually talented enough or confident enough. I was way too scared. So I didn't actually do the plays at school, but I would sing along at home. So I pretend that I had the Annie potential. Anyway, so for me, singing in my room, there is no better song than I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here and NYC.
Oh, wow.
I was wrong.
Wow.
Which I kind of roll those together.
Oh, NYC is interesting.
We would not be greater than Newlywed Game. I don't know if you can read what I wrote.
It says maybe.
Okay, wait. Also maybe. Wait, there's so many. I mean, what a song to start on, too. If you want to, like, relate to Annie and get the tug on your heartstrings moment, maybe it's Superior to Tomorrow. I would put those in the ballad. So, like, I was picking a ballad.
When you had that response to Tomorrow, I was almost sure you were going to pick Maybe.
Sorry. But yes, I would say between the ballads, Maybe absolutely wins.
But, I mean, here's what's amazing, right? I think that to show how deep this musical goes, none of us are picking Hard Knock Life, which is still a stone cold classic, right? Like, that's still a song that, like, if you said, sing me a song from Annie, that's probably the song that people know.
Or Tomorrow. Yeah. But there.
Even Easy Street, like, Alan Cumming, like the bridge of Easy Street.
Number,
there's so
man.
Many good moments.
Yeah. It's a great, Easy Street's never been better than in this version.
It's very, very good.
And because
not the auto-tuned Bobby Cannavale and Diaz version, you sure?
Is Bobby Cannavale and who?
Diaz.
But the thing about that version is I love almost everybody in that cast so much too. But it wasn't that I was looking forward to it. You could tell from the trailers how terrible it was. Oof. But it's a great cast. You know, the thing about I'm going to go back on what I'm saying. It's a great cast and I love them. They're all miscast. Annie, when it's filmed, is supposed to be pulling the best from Broadway. You just are. That's more than almost anything else. You just should pull the biggest and the best from Broadway.
At the very least, if you're going to update Annie for a Brave New World, pull the best pop stars. Do a Brandy Whitney. Like, pull some
Dream
proven
Girls.
Singers. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're all great, but they're not the strongest singers.
So obviously the 2014 Annie was a disaster, right? But is there a version of Annie, a Lin-Manuel Miranda version of Annie or something along those lines where, like, you actually can successfully try to bridge that sort of diversity and try to kind of, you know, do something more with just, you know, different types of people? I don't know if the answer, I'm certainly not necessarily pitching this. I'm just saying, like, I think that's kind of what they thought they were doing.
The answer is, of course, there is. There's always, I would never say no. You never know you never know what an artist is going to do with something.
Right.
But I would keep the story as simple and the core as pure as possible.
Right.
But again, you never know. So.
Yeah. I mean, well, NBC, that is this year's live holiday musical is Annie. And we've got Taraji P. Henson as Mrs. Hannigan.
Perfect cast.
Tyus Burgess as Rooster. Nicole Scherzinger as Grace. And Harry Connick Jr. as Daddy Warbucks. So they're getting, Nicole Scherzinger is classically trained and maybe an opera singer in a pat. Like, I think she has the chops.
Oh, Nicole Scherzinger is an incredible performer.
Yeah,
I know it sounds crazy, but I stumbled upon, I think it was a YouTube video or something where someone was, I think it was a Twitter, I think it was a tweet where someone retweeted something, which was essentially like, don't sleep on Nicole Scherzinger. What she is capable of is shocking. But again, like, this is not the role where you shine. This is not the flashiest role, but that's, we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. Actually, gave me look like
99.
I'm wrong.
Well, because 99, Audra, like, that was my introduction to Audra McDonald. That made me love Audra McDonald and want to see whatever she was in. So I feel like it, again, my favorite song. I think I'm going to like it here. Like, that gives Grace a big song to sing.
It's potentially a great production, too. You're the first time you're in the house. And yeah.
Yeah. And you've
got... Is this for Fox? Is this what you said? Foxes? Or who is it?
NBC. Live musical, and it's got Neil Marin, who was one of the producers on Cinderella and R99 Annie, back. So I'm assuming they're going to do it pretty true to what we're used to with Annie and not go radical with modernizing to Will Stax and his cell phone empire. But and they've got a newcomer, Annie Selena Smith, who is a Black Annie. So, you know, diversifying again in the main roles, which is good.
That's
to
great.
See.
And they only, you know, because it's live and this version had the vibe of something that felt it obviously wasn't, but it had that vibe of something that was being performed in the moment. Because that's mm-hmm. life. You can't put on too many bells or whistles. No matter what, it's going to feel grounded and terrestrial. And I think the live musical thing is cool and interesting. I don't love it in the sense that it has completely usurped the idea of doing what they did with Annie and Cinderella.
No. It's,
there should also be a lane for filmed and edited TV musicals, but
I feel like with a live TV musical, a big draw, to be honest, you're watching in case something goes wrong. I mean, yeah, that's the live TV show. You want to see if they forget the lines, if they don't hit the note, if a set piece falls in the background. I don't feel like I revisit live TV musicals. I watch them when they happen. I don't have, you know, Grease and the Allison Williams, Peter Pan, you know, in my library to return to. Whereas
Grease was good. You know, I thought Grease was pretty good.
Grease was good. Grease was good. But Grease, do you rewatch good. It all the time? I don't know.
No.
I don't think so. I watched it once. Love the sound. It's, yeah.
It's still, Grease is another one that, you know, I don't like Grease. I think Grease actually is kind of dangerous, to be honest.
I think Grease's soundtrack is superior to Grease, the movie, or the actual musical.
That's what I was kind of going to get at. That, again, it's another cake pan. But I'm so disillusioned by the end of that movie, by the final conclusion of what you're supposed to do in order to make your life better, that it kind of kills a lot of what they're doing. But the music's incredible and the dancing is incredible. And I just like to forget about the end of the movie and just pretend that. No, not that they fly away.
I know.
The flying away is awesome.
The transformation.
That she turns into a pig lady.
The of Rizzo.
I understand.
Yeah. And but I mean, as much as Annie let... sorry.
No, please go. No, well, no.
Annie let kids shine, and Grease lets like 45-year-olds play high schoolers. So there's really no chance to relate to.
That's fun too, though. That's
a young person.
I love when you get like a 55-year-old Kinnicky out there. It's like, oh, Joe Piscopo's playing Kinnicky.
Amazing.
Yeah, I know. What I was gonna say though about the Peter Pan with Allison Williams is that I only watched about 10 minutes of it because it was impossible to actually watch the entire thing. Was that it felt like it was Marnie from Girls. Yeah. Like, I couldn't help but think that it was some sort of weird Girls extended universe where Marnie is in this fucking live musical.
It was some of the strangest. And I love Allison Williams. I love Girls and I love Marnie. Sure. And I think it was some of the, and I don't think she's like in a vacuum, not a bad choice. But she only was known for one thing. It was so, and it so was not bizarre. This thing.
Not
you
this
know,
thing.
It was not something that anybody who, well, not anybody, but any child who would want to watch Peter Pan would have any sense of. It was very.
And the one thing she was known for, she played a bad singer on it. Like, she did a bad song. So you get the person known for doing a bad song to be your star in a thing where she should sing a good song.
It's, and the Chris Walken stuff was just terrifying. Like, it was one of those things you're just like, what are we doing? Anyway, it doesn't matter. I want to just talk for a second about Christian Chenoweth, because there's a moment in this Annie that I love where she's bullied by the orphans, which only works because Kristen Chenoweth is the height of an orphan. So you actually believe that she could be bullied by a group of like 7-year-olds. It's fantastic.
It's a great moment.
I do have to ask about the FDR stuff at the end, where Franklin Roosevelt shows up.
There's a little more, but yeah, that's that when I say it's a review, that's what I mean. It's just kind of like Andy greatest hits.
Yeah, no, 100%. But it's I've never like a deus ex machina that's Franklin Roosevelt is amazing to me. Like where you're just like, pulled this guy out of a hat and he's going to solve all the problems. He's going to find parents for all these orphans. He's going to make sure that we're in the middle of the Great Depression, but he's going to make sure these kids find parents. I loved it. It's insane.
I feel like more than anything, it's just a testament to reinforce how powerful Daddy Warbucks is, that he has got the president on speed dial, that he comes to his house and he's you know, travels across state lines. But I think in the musical, like there's more FDR, like there are more songs about FDR. There's more, he's woven in to a greater degree. And I think Disney being Disney, obviously like kind of just pulled back on the politics, stripped it of any sort of two complicated notions. Right. Not that they were doing deep stuff with FDR, but yeah. And Judge Brandeis, I think, is like, there's historical figures. Yes. That they, FBI, like there are all kinds of people that they bring into the fray.
What's kind of fun about it, I think, is how when this came out in the late 70s, I don't think it was that weird. I don't think it played. I obviously it's crazy. Don't get me wrong, but I don't think it played that crazy. I think it kind of played. It's just, sure, FDR is a character in this musical.
I think there's also just, you mentioned this a little bit, Ashley, but like this movie can only be 90 minutes. It's airing on ABC. They have a certain amount of commercials.
90 minutes.
It just has to be in this tight box. So to your point, FDR is going to be like, here's FDR.
Mr. Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's fantastic. I want to, so in the 82 version, Mrs. Hannigan is perhaps killed. Hard to say.
She might come back. I don't remember. There is a shot of her like splayed on the ground while they shimmy away. And she had been knocked unconscious over the head by her croony rooster.
She's a cockroach. It's more she's not going anywhere.
For sure.
Yeah.
But so there in this version, it does feel like she's being carted off to like a psychiatric hospital.
Yes,
or
she definitely is. Yes.
But it definitely feels that way. Like they Hannibal Lecter her basically and put her on like a cart and they kind of like, so it's a little, you know, it's insinuated. In the 82 version, does she get taken away or is the last we see of her? I'm just curious as to, considering how dark this 82 version is, I'm just wondering how they wrapped up arguably the darkest character of the movie.
I think she's either dead or goes to jail. She's not treated. She's not rehabable.
Okay. Right.
No, I don't think. Okay. I can't remember. I think maybe Rooster and Lily are also in jail. I don't remember.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
But it's definitely bleaker. But I will say, Kenny, just to your this is not art argument, and that Annie doesn't, you know, get any.
This is not high art.
It's not high art. It did win 99 Annie. Won two Emmys. It had a Golden Globe, and whatever it's worth, it had a Golden Globe nomination for Kathy Bates. You know, it had critical acclaim in a way. The 82 version, we should note, was panned by critics. Critics hated the 82 film. It was seen as, you know, derivative and bad. And 99, overwhelmingly, they liked it.
I want to make it clear what I'm trying to say. Okay. The property Annie, I don't think lends itself to quote unquote high art. Mm-hmm. That being said, like, I think this is a very successful piece of work. It won two Emmys. It also won a Peabody, you know, which is not nothing. It's pretty important. So it was really, really well done. And I think art goes beyond what the movie is saying thematically and what it's doing narratively. And I think this is a really good example of that, that the physical production and the physical work, like the choreography, is just exceptional. And it's just a really, really wonderful 90 minutes. It breezes by. So I think, yeah, I do. I think this is the best version of Annie I've ever seen. And I think it's really good. I mean, there are a lot of musicals like Cats that you could do the greatest possible version of it, and I would still think it's a heaping pile of shit because I think Cats is just the worst thing on the book of Cats is as bad as Cats. But Annie's not like that. Cats. I think Annie's more malleable, and I think you're able to fuck it up and you're able to make something really wonderful.
Yeah.
Better songs than Cats too.
Yes.
Cats is the worst.
It has more crossover potential, more a wider audience you can definitely reach with Annie than a Cats. But I think something the 99 version changed as well, which, as I was saying, one of my favorite songs, NYC, that scene. And I believe in the Broadway play, definitely in the 82 film and the 2014 film, they go to see a movie. It's just like they go see a movie. It's not... Mm-hmm. And in 99, they go to a Broadway musical, giving Rob another chance to do a big choreography. And they have Andrea McArdle, who was the original Annie on Broadway, come back in a cameo. So I feel like there's a lot more of this like homage to the essence of Annie in our 99 version than anything else that pays tribute to those humble roots.
I think Annie is something to be revered in a way. I think Annie is something that you see as a child. It is one of your first musicals. For a lot of kids, I think it's the moment, one, they see themselves on stage, and two, you start to see the grandeur of live live performance. And that's the magic. That's, you know, my favorite musical is probably A Chorus Line. And the piece from that, you know, it always stands out for everybody, well, every grown up, is At the Ballet. And it's that same idea of being a little kid and seeing something so beautiful that it's like, or so big and beautiful and well choreographed and large in the life that it's overwhelming, but that you want to be a part of it. And I do think that that's the power that Annie holds. Maybe I was being a little too derisive with not high art, but that's really besides.
No, I'm just defensive. And it's totally the case of the things that you saw when you were 10 and 12 are high art. Like it is the highest of high. A Walk to Remember can do no wrong. Like those movies
impacted you
in that time. Yeah.
It is just kind of besides the point to me to even look at it that way, because it's a really important cultural piece. It's evergreen, right? It's a perennial. And you know,
it's comfort food.
It's trying to
have a message, I think.
Yeah, but it matters. It really does matter. And just like, you know, look, the Annie who is cast in this new one, you said her name was
Selena Smith.
Casting a new Annie, cast a new Annie, is a cultural moment, and it matters. Yeah. And it's often a moment for progressivism. It's also, you know, the last two major Annies have been Black, and that's kind of a big thing. And, you know, Kwabenja Bay Wallace kind of, did I say the name wrong?
Kwabenja
Wallace took like the arrows and slings for everybody, because, you know, people like to throw arrows and slings at nine-year-old girls. But she broke down that door, and that's probably the best legacy of that version.
Yes,
for sure.
But now you have.
And she is a talented singer. She is good. We should mention that she is good in the 2014 Annie. The autotune, that is
she's
not on her.
She's not
she
the problem.
Giving her all. And she was already an Oscar nominee at that point. And she's great.
She's the only piece of casting that makes any sense in that film.
I agree.
But it is. It's an important thing. It's casting a new Annie is like, you know, it's like casting a new fucking Luke Skywalker or whatever.
It also just feels like so my parents are friends with one of the original producers of the Broadway Annie. And I've you know, chatted with him about it over the years periodically, but just the to your point, Kenny, the sheer sort of evergreenness of this, the fact that these songs are completely untouchable, that they are beloved in people's bones, that it transcends all generations, it transcends all, you know, various sort of types of people. That's an amazing thing. Like, that's a truly powerful thing. And, you know, we should commend that. It's an amazing thing.
It's an interesting kind of Broadway unicorn in that it was Charles Strauss or Strauss, I think is how you say his name. Mm-hmm. Or Strauss, I'm not sure. Who wrote the music for this. Mm-hmm. And he's not your Sondheim. He is not your Rodgers and Hammerstein. He is not even Andrew Lloyd Webber. He is not, you know, the 80% of show tunes people know were written by about seven people. And he's not one of them. And I think that's very unusual. He wrote Bye Bye Birdie too, which is a big Broadway musical. But aside from that, like he's a lesser known guy. So that's a kind of cool thing. This is not about Sondheim completists or Howard Ashman people like pushing this stuff to the forefront and being like, you have to listen to everything this person's done. This really stands on its own merits, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been, I mean, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia right now. There have been 18 productions of this Annie in terms of on Broadway or various, you know, like theatrical productions of this. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's an amazing thing. It's a cottage industry, Annie.
Yeah. I don't have the stats, but I would imagine it might be the biggest original Broadway musical success story, not the longest running or anything like that, but as far as adaptations, just awareness in the general cultural conscious. Like, I think, you know, Annie, the recognition that you could have asking a 10-year-old about Annie, a 75-year-old, and in like rural Kansas and New York, like, any people know Annie in a way that, like, even a Bye Bye Birdie, that's much more of a theater. Like, you have to be in, you know, kind of in touch with theater or the old movie version to be aware. But Annie just really transcends so many demographics.
More it's also, like, and, yeah. Forgive me for not knowing this. So it is based on a comic strip strip that I didn't know existed. Started and launched
in
Little Orphan Annie and Uncle Dan. I don't know who Uncle Dan is, but that's the name of the comic. It launched in 1924 is when it launched, which is incredible to think. There's a whole thing here that I didn't know nearly enough about, but just sort of like this goes deep. I feel like this goes deep in sort of Americana and just sort of American culture, that Annie is in the DNA of this country in a way I really didn't know.
Yeah, I think it is.
It's really fascinating. I don't know if you've listened to our episodes previously, actually, but at the end of every episode, we do a rating of the movie, from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. 50% is the threshold of recommending or not recommending. I think we're all going to recommend this, obviously. But we also do it twice. We rate it from before the podcast and after the podcast. So to see if there was changes and if the discussion affected your rating in one way or another. So I'll go first. Hadn't seen this before. You know, as I said, the songs are incredible. I was really taken with it. I was surprised by how just like charming and lovely. And so I give it a 72 going into this podcast. But this talk has made me like it more. I'm at a 77 now. I think it's just a really good movie. I really do think that, like, I absolutely watch it again. It makes me, I definitely got to go see this. I got to watch this 82 version because it sounds like a horror show that I need to see. And also, quite honestly, like, I'm now kind of excited to see this live one, which is happening in December, theoretically, if this, you know, who knows what exists in December, but hopefully it will exist in December. I'm at a 77. I think it's, I'm thrilled that you brought this to our attention. This is great. What about you, Kenny? Where are you at?
Well, I think it's interesting because I don't think I ever would have watched the live one, had I not watched this one, and kind of
same.
I was kind of reminded how much I love the songs. And I think that's a very cool thing about Broadway musicals in general, that it's never the story that brings me back. It's always the songs and waiting for those songs, waiting for those moments and those performances and the emotional component of it.
Totally.
And that's why I think, despite the fact that Annie, I think, is kind of a narrative mess, I think it's such a potent piece of work. Because the music and the emotionality of it are in the exact right place. I gave it an 84 before the podcast because I really truly loved it. And you know, I'm not going to go much higher. 84. Maybe I'll go to like an 86. If that's pretty high, but I really loved it.
Right.
Like you have to follow your heart on these things. And I don't have much to say negatively about it, aside from the fact that it's not high art, but it's it's not Eyes Wide Shut, but it's close. So I really do love it. Thank you, Ashley. I don't think we would have done this otherwise. So I think this is I'm really happy. It was all the crap we watch. It was really great to watch it. A wonderful breezy hour and a half with like 8 great numbers.
Well, pleasure.
I'll just say before you rate it that the double bill of Ride with the Devil and Annie was quite the whiplash this week.
Seriously. Seriously. If it was anything else, if I had to watch Blood Brothers or something, I would have blown my brains out. Unfortunately, there's no Blood Brothers on TV at 99.
So you saw this in 99. So I'd actually love to hear what your rating of this was back then and then what it is now. Is it perfect 99 back then?
As you can tell, I'm extremely biased. I'm sure I sat in front of the TV and watched this live. I then bought the soundtrack, had the DVD, kept this in my consciousness for the next like 5 years, or until it, you know, I clearly wasn't a cool child, but it was became excessively uncool to be watching my any DVD. So I absolutely would have given it a 99. I would have, you know, I think as a kid, it was flawless to me. The songs, right. Like I said, Audra McDonald, like for me, her voice, like that just, and even Kristen Chenoweth, like this kind of was my first introduction to these people. And then, you know, Kristen came out with her own kind of pop albums and different things, and I would buy those. And it introduced me to Broadway actors in a way that growing up in Florida, I had seen regional productions, but I wasn't in that world. I didn't, you know, this introduced me to a lot of material and people's work that I would not have encountered before. Mm-hmm. Also, I had been a big Titanic fan, and we got Victor Garber and Kathy Bates back.
Mm-hmm. So that's true.
Everything was going for it. I wanted to be Alicia Morton. I loved it. Flawless. Absolutely. Now, I hadn't seen it. I don't think I had watched it since probably 2002 or something. Mm-hmm. And it's now on Disney Plus, which is handy. Is. So anyone who wants to watch it, you can go find it now. When I rewatched it and I started rewatching it, I will say the beginning, I was like, oh, this doesn't really have the magic that I quite remembered, which often happens when you go back to something you loved as a kid. But then the best song, I think I'm going to like it here, kicks in. And that big foyer scene in Daddy Warbucks' house with the servants doing the choreography and Annie getting her little mini makeover and put in the little blue coat, and then NYC, and they go to the theater. Like, I like goosebumps. I love it. I live for that. Like, that is what I want. I love a Disney, you know, feel good moment. And I think when you talk about the messaging and stuff, like, at the very least, it's not, there's nothing overly offensive about Annie. Like, it can be bland, but there, you could maybe, you know, take issues with the capitalist messages and stuff, but overall, it's okay, like, it's to, not, yeah. There's
it's
nothing
okay to have fairy tales. It's okay to fantasize about this stuff. That's not,
it is a Cinderella story, and it is just such a feel good watch. Now, so, okay, my rating, I don't know where, what point I rate the post podcast, because I will say during the research for the Annie for this podcast and finding out about the Audra McDonald, the kiss stuff and some of the racism like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that puts a damper in it. And when you start thinking about how they could have done better casting and been more inclusive, like I think, you know, as an adult and looking at the world as we do now, like I definitely would knock points off for that, especially when I loved Cinderella too. And that was so wonderful. And then to see them take a step back. So maybe I go down to a 91. But I still like, and you're right. It's the music. It's those songs. They kick in and the vocals are wonderful in this version. Yeah. It so good. It has that spark. So
it's really, I love it. Yeah. It's the Broadway bona fides of this version really do kind of put it head and shoulders above any other version, it seems.
Yeah. Including Kathy. Garber. Well, Victor Garber. Yeah. He's a Stone Cold Broadway man.
Legend. Yeah.
Legend. I remember I saw him in Damn Yankees before I knew who he was, probably like 25 years ago.
I think that Rob Marshall worked on that with him as well. Like probably. That they were tied to that. Yeah.
The one character, the one actress I probably on paper would have been not thrilled about or was not thrilled about before I heard her was Kathy Bates, which felt a little bit like, let's put a star in this role instead of giving the role, because that's a Broadway role, right? That is a scene chewing big Broadway actress role. She was great. I do think that there are dozens upon dozens of actors who could have done better, but it's not on her. Like it's a pet peeve of mine to give a singing role to someone who, not that they can't sing, but that they can't sing as well as people who do this like on a regular basis.
Like Sweeney Todd, for instance? Would that fit in your... or La La Land?
Yeah, La La Land's the one. La La Land is... I mean, Ryan Gosling in La La Land is the one for me that really like sticks in my craw. Yeah.
But I almost like... I'm okay with Miss Hannigan being kind of an unhinged bad singer because it just adds to like, oh, this woman... She's just bad all around. Like, it adds to her kind of unraveling that her voice is not bad all perfect.
But it wasn't bad. She was good.
She's good. The legend goes that she told Victor Garber while they were filming Titanic that she would love to do a movie musical one day. And he put in a good word with Rob Marshall. and got kind of her foot in the door to do this. So I think it was kind of like a personal passion project of Kathy Bates. She was like, this is my chance.
Very cool.
Rather than just doing it for the money. Like, I think she really loved it.
And an ABC Wide World of Disney, Wonderful World of Disney, Sunday Night Musical. There are more offensive things than to it there. Like Ryan Gosling in La La Land in a role that should have gone to someone who's worked their whole fucking life for a role like that. But
yeah. No, I hear that. Well,
that's what drives me nuts. There's so many fucking, sorry, not to rant. There's so many people who have worked their whole lives for singing and dancing performances like that. And they come along every like 4 fucking years, and to give it a Ryan Gosling. Now, I thought Emma Stone was great and I loved her in it. So it's not her. Like, of course there are Hollywood actors who can pull it off. Come on. All right, that's it.
Ryan Gosling, now he did start on the Mickey Mouse Club. Like, he did have a little, he was a great dancer.
That's true.
In theory, was a good child singer. I don't know that he kept up his craft over the years, but he does have a bit of that background to give him credit.
Kenny and I have talked about this a lot because La La Land is one of Kenny's daughter's favorite movies, if I'm not mistaken,
certainly come around on it.
I'm the same way. I saw it in the theaters right after the election, and I was just like, yes, pump this into my veins, like, sure. And then I kind of soured on it, and now I've come back to it, and I just think it's a nice movie. I just don't think it, you know, it has to be thankful it didn't win Best Picture. If it won Best Picture, it would be denigrated so much more than it already is.
No movie has ever benefited more from losing.
One thing, if I can just say one more thing about Annie that I realized we forgot to mention that I feel is kind of an important part of its place in pop culture ongoing, is that this version of Tomorrow, Alicia Morton in 99, is what Ryan Reynolds used in Deadpool 2 for the shootout scene. So Ryan Reynolds clearly recognizes this as the definitive Annie that we should all look to.
It's fair. It's reasonable. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about Annie with us, Ashley. We really, really appreciate it. And we hope that you'll come back in the future and talk about something else, music, movies, TV, whatever.
I would love it.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.